This week, we flipped the script. In the leadership and communications section, what it takes to be a transformational CISO. Put your metrics where your mouth is, five simple ways to make better decisions, and more. In our second segment, we welcome Param Eftekhari, Senior Vice President and Executive Director of the Cybersecurity Collaborative, to discuss the power of true peer-to-peer collaboration. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Week. With over half of enterprise security budgets going towards detection and response in 2020, the challenge is investing in solutions that can migrate and scale with your business. ExtraHop helps security teams spot threats up to 95% faster and respond 60% more efficiently in hybrid and multi-cloud environments with cloud-native network detection and response. Kick the tires in the full product demo at securityweekly.com/ExtraHop. The most at-risk industries like financial, tech, and government agencies use web isolation to keep their networks and users secure. The Silo Web Isolation platform by Authenticate allows users to experience the web in full isolation, eliminating the chance of a web-borne cyber attack. You can interact with malicious files and websites without worry, even if you're working remotely. Authenticate enables anyone, anywhere, on any device to experience the web without risk. See how it works at securityweekly.com/authenticate. The question is simple. Have any of the systems on my network been compromised? The answer is harder than it should be. Enter AI Hunter. Active Countermeasures has automated and streamlined techniques used by the best pen testers and threat hunters in the industry to create AI Hunter, a network threat hunting solution that does the first pass of a hunt for you to identify systems that are most likely to be compromised and scores the results on a scale from 0 to 100. You can then research those systems in depth with AI Hunter. Focus your valuable time on the systems that need your expertise with AI Hunter. Sign up for a personal demo today at securityweekly.com/ACM.
Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 190, recorded October 5th, 2020. I am your host, Matt Alderman, here in sunny Colorado. Joining me from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island are my co-hosts, Mr. Paul Asadorian and Mr. Jason Albuquerque.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, good to be here.
You guys are on the new set. You got the new mics. You're looking fantastic.
It's a great setup.
Yeah, we did. I did a round of upgrades. It was. I'm really super happy with it. Yeah, actually, a couple
nice.
More. Couple more to go.
There smaller, you go.
Yeah, but it's fun.
Yeah, smaller. You got a budget to stick to. Remember that.
That's what Johnny's giving me crap about that. Actually, he's like, that's gonna eat up our budget. I know, but like it's we need that.
The audiophile and Paul. Do you have a specific guest or topic that you want us to cover on one of the shows? Submit your suggestions for guests by visiting securityweekly.com/guests and completing the form. We will review those suggestions monthly and reach out once they've been approved. It's official. Security Weekly, in partnership with Cyber Risk Alliance, is excited to present Security Weekly Unlocked on December 10th, 2020. The inaugural edition of Security Weekly Unlocked also celebrates Security Weekly's 15th anniversary. Registration and call for speakers is now open. Visit securityweekly.com/unlock to submit your speaking session and register for free. All right. It's October, flu season starting up. Our original guest is sick, so we flipped the script today. We're going to start with articles and then do a second segment with Param, part from the Cyber Risk Alliance portfolio. So last week, Jason, we were talking about the different roles and habits of CISOs. This week, we talk about the characteristics of CISOs.
Yeah. Yeah, this first article, I think, is looking at it from a next-generation CISO perspective, right? What does it mean to be a next-generation CISO?
Yeah, and it's funny because when you read these and then you look at the next article, which is this concept of a transformational CISO, mm-hmm. which is also, I think, a next generation CISO, you've got some differences, but you have some overlap. So it was interesting to compare these two articles on what is the next generation CISO? What skill set? And one thing that popped out is look, you better be ready for change.
No doubt about it. I mean, that's the biggest.
More so than ever before, we all have to be embracing change.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think some of it is a change in mentality, though, right? Because, you know, historically, the security team has kind of been that sentry, that gatekeeper, where now it's a mentality of, listen, if you're not enabling the business, you're a roadblock. And the business doesn't want a roadblock, right? They want somebody who can partner with the business. One of the worst things I've heard is when a leader comes in and says, oh, you're from the security team? You're like kind of, you're the company's insurance policy, right? And you know, that drives me crazy. So no, I mean, we're here to be an enabler of the business. We're here to partner with the business. We're not here to be a roadblock. And I think that's when this first article says, balance opportunity with risk. Mm-hmm. And that's what I pulled out of that piece is, listen, be there for the business, be a business enabler. Don't be viewed as a roadblock. Demonstrate, you know, that leadership level that you can partner with the business and truly show the value.
Yeah. And it's more of a value proposition now that CISOs really have to think about. What value am I providing back to the business? How can I enable security, but also allow the business to continue to do what it is there to do, which is, look, it's there to create revenue, create profit, create jobs, right? And sometimes security is looked at as an inhibitor to that.
Right.
So how do you embrace the opportunity that the business has and also provide a level of security along the way?
And again, it's a shift in mindset, right? And us as leaders, if you want the seat at the table, you got to be ready to take that seat at the table and everything that comes with it, right? It's the relationship building. Some of it is the politics side. Some of it is sitting back and saying, you want to know what? I may have to take a different tactic to get this accomplished or a different road to get this accomplished. Let's figure out the outcomes. We talk about outcomes all the time. Let's figure out what the outcomes are, and let's figure out a way that collaboratively we can get to those outcomes together.
Yeah, I think it's what I would add to this list and maybe enhancing what's already there, right, is breaking down silos, making sure you don't create silos and making sure that you break down ones that exist. And security itself traditionally it can fall into this silo where you're like, well, if you need a firewall rule change, you got to throw it over to the security people, right? And they're going to decide like how long that takes and you know, there's SLAs in place and all that stuff, to really being in partnership and breaking down those silos. Also, the communication skills, something we've talked about on the show in the past, is you have to be able to communicate effectively to many different audiences, right? You have to talk to your user base, finance, legal, HR, technical people, not technical people. And that's super important. And I think a subset of you can have good communication skills, but knowing how to tune those and apply those to different audiences is definitely
100% correct. Yeah. I mean, there was a section in here called finding their own voice is one of the success criteria.
Yeah, I would lump that in there.
And honestly, it's find your own voice, but know your audience. Right? Know your audience when you're sitting at the executive table with all the other business unit leaders and how you articulate something, but you could articulate that differently, right?
Yeah.
Different audiences.
Knowing and doing are two different things. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you got to make that mistake and be like, oh, that was the wrong way to communicate with that audience before it's fine-tuned, right? Like, guilty. I've done that. Learn the hard way.
Yeah.
Yeah. The second article brings out a couple good points, right? Dynamic and adaptable, and back again to communication, where you almost have to be a salesman a little bit. You know, when you think about it, you're trying to sell aspects of security to these other groups and be like, no, really, you need this, right? And those communication skills definitely come into play to be able to understand your audience, how to communicate with them and get them on board. And that's a set of soft skills that you're going to see more and more important, not just for the CISO, but I think for security professionals in general.
Oh, absolutely, right? I mean, some of it in here is you know, one of them is be more open to our alternatives, right? Make sure there's no gray area. Be open to gray area, and that there is gray area. Sorry, but that's a key where we can't be sitting in a meeting and just definitively say no, we can't do that, right? Sometimes you have to leave a meeting that may have multiple executives in it and have a sidebar conversation, right? I mean, sometimes you have to support the other people that are there and not make definitive decisions in public.
Even though you know the answer is going to be no.
Even though you know the answer is going to be no, because you still want to keep that constituency
That should be your book. You. How to say no without saying no.
Right.
That's really like it'd be a great book for CISOs because you really.
It's true. Yeah. It's true, right? Because yeah. again, you want to make sure you continue to have those folks support, mm-hmm. but by just flat out making decisions and meetings in front of other folks, again, know your audience, know place and time for certain conversations. You know, sometimes you're better off staying silent and then having a sidebar conversation after, right? And making those decisions together.
Yeah, I think as you grow, I hope that folks find themselves not saying no, but saying, you know, I'd like to work with you to figure mm-hmm. out
that's
how to
key.
Get this done,
that's
right?
The key.
And yep. you may decide that it's still not going to happen, but maybe it does happen in a slightly different way, right? And you make compromises.
Yeah, and ultimately, the goal is to get the folks you're working with to support that decision. Mm. It won't always happen, but at least work for that.
Well, that's the thing. It's easier to just say no.
Yeah.
Like, no, we can't.
Totally.
We can't.
Totally.
Do it, right?
You're right.
Yeah. Right. So I'm going to skip down to the CIO mm-hmm. article that says, look, security, you better be ready for permanent work from home. So yeah. I have this question for you, Jason. Sure. Are you telling yourself to be ready for security?
We're at a point now where we had prepped for this for so long. That, you know, it was an open runway for us, right? I mean, we're different than other companies, though. We're a technology company, right? So 80% of our workforce was already remote or had remote capabilities and didn't have to be in the office. So we were prepped for that. But at the end of the day, any organization, you know, should have that level of preparation, but just strategically have to scale it, I would think, right? So yeah, I mean, even if you only had 5 people who were remote in your organization at that point in time, you should have been focusing on security around your remote workforce.
Yeah.
That's my thought.
Right.
But I do think security teams are much more likely to be in a position to work from home for a lot of reasons, right? In number one, COVID aside, the talent shortage, right? Mm-hmm. And the ability to find the right talent, you can't always find that in your area.
Yeah.
And I think for that reason, a lot of security folks, especially on the research side, already work from home.
Yeah.
Because it's hard to find people with that
right,
unique
right, right.
skill set. The other thing is when you're responding to an incident, as an example, you can always bring, oftentimes, let's face it, incidents happen off hours. Mm-hmm. And so we learned over time how to collaborate remotely and have remote access to the things we needed so that we could respond to that incident
right,
remotely.
Because
right. oftentimes they're on nights and weekends. And, you know, if you're on vacation that day or whatever, guess what? If you're a key piece of that incident response, like you're getting pulled in, especially if the organization's at stake, if it's a high enough criticality mm-hmm. incident. So, for those two reasons, I mean, security has to be able to work
right,
from
right.
home just for those two reasons, and that COVID isn't even on that list yet, right?
Yeah. Right. Just to put it back into the context of the article, though, this was heavily focused on public sector. And what I will say is public sector, in the most part, isn't always ready, especially when you get down to the state and local government yeah. side of the aisle. They're not always prepped, right? So I can see it from that perspective, looking at it from, you know, the public sector, state, local education, that type of stuff. You know, they need to be ready to have certain amount of people working from home.
Well, because there's a cost with setting that up,
right?
It's making sure that everyone's got their laptops, mm-hmm. making sure you're subscribed to the right conferencing software, the right
yep.
chat software, collaboration software, VPNs, concentrators. Oh, by the way, if I need to power something off in the mm-hmm. in the data center, if I still have stuff in a data center, let's face it, many people do, right? I need equipment for that, and that needs to be monitored, maintained, and all that stuff. So,
yeah, and you know, the public sector is a lot different from the private sector and the fact that you're forced to have a lot of your information open.
Mm.
So it's really being able to define what is open access information versus what is not, mm-hmm. right? And really figuring out that. I mean, you talk about it all the time, right? It's you know, it's identity, it's application, it's data, right? That you need to protect. And a lot of that in the public sector has to be open just because of the laws.
Yeah. But when it is confidential, mm-hmm. now that means you've got SCIFs everywhere
yep.
For people to consume this data if they can't get to a central location. So right. it does put some different challenges for different industries. You know, financials have been heavily on-prem versus remote. This will be a shift for them. And what the article is trying to say is, look, I mean, we got to think about these new threat vectors and attack vectors that are going to emerge if we keep the majority, if not all of our employees in a remote home situation. Some people thought this was temporary, and others are saying, no, this is probably a little more permanent. Mm-hmm. We better be ready.
Yeah, I think for certain departments, it's going to be a lot more permanent. Security and software development, for sure. Even for financial. I mean, I don't have a great scientific, I didn't study this in any scientific manner, but you know, talking to some of my friends that work in finance, like they're all on security teams and they're all working from home.
Yeah. At the end of the day, it's going to be a business decision, right? And organization's going to look at it and say, why do I need this brick and mortar building that I'm paying for electricity, for heating, for cooling, for water, for all of this overhead when I don't need it? When my teams have been successful over the past 6-7 months, they're going to revisit it, right? And they're going to look at leases and they're going to look at selling off buildings. And I'm going to make the assumption that public sector will mature to that eventually anyway, right? Because they're going to start seeing that, wow, we've had 50% of our workforce not have to be in a building. Mm-hmm. Can we continue to do this and not have that burden on the taxpayer of having to pay for these buildings? Right.
Ooh, maybe we can balance a budget?
Oh, who would think?
Wishful thinking.
Who would think?
Wishful thinking.
Wishful thinking. Because if you give them the money, they're going to figure out how to spend it.
Spend it somewhere else.
100%. This next article was an interesting article. We talk about metrics a lot.
Yeah.
And I thought this was a really interesting article about how what you say is your mission and how you align that to your key performance indicators sometimes comes back to bite you in the butt. I thought this was a really good lesson. It's an HBR, Harvard Business Review article about Rio Tinto and who they claim their stakeholders are. But when you looked at their KPIs and how they reported, there wasn't really alignment there. And I thought it was just a really good example for people to right size their KPIs.
Yeah, 100%. And at the end of the day, what you're measured on drives behavior. That's how it goes, right? I mean, you know, there's always that long, that funny saying in sales, right? You know, the metrics you give your salespeople are going to drive what they sell. So if you want to sell, if you want them to sell certain things, make the metrics do that for you. Otherwise, they're just going to keep selling what they sold over time, right? It's the same idea. You know, those metrics that you judge different folks on, their success criteria, are going to drive certain behaviors. So you have to make sure that you're setting up these drivers to the outcome that you're looking to achieve, right? And I thought it was funny about, you know, the company that they talked about, you know, they basically said customers, community, our people, and our shareholders are that's our main focus, that's our main mission. But the metrics did not prove that at all.
They were all shareholder folks. Well,
yeah, pretty much.
At the end of the day, because it was all around the financials, pretty much. Mm-hmm. I think they had one about zero emissions from a green, from a carbon emissions footprint. Yeah. But when you look at a lot of the other ones, they were all focused heavily on the shareholder because they had financial ramifications to the shareholder, but didn't think about those other stakeholders.
Yeah, right. And then what's going to drive the behavior for the decisions that the CEO makes? Knowing that. Right. Knowing that the metrics that he's driving to, he or she are driving to, is all about the shareholder. So that's what they're going to make their decisions on.
Yeah. So we're getting ready to go through this process of identifying KPIs. So this was a relevant article.
I was going to say, this is pretty timely.
Yeah. It is for us. Because I'm like, if we're going to identify our KPIs, we better make sure they align to all of our stakeholders, which includes the community, which is a big part of what we do here, and employees and our sponsors, right? We have three really big stakeholders here. So it was a good lesson for me to think about all three of those stakeholders when we start to establish KPIs and our budgeting process under the new Cyber Risk Alliance umbrella. Yep. So I learned something. The next article, 5 simple ways to make better decisions. I just go to the last one, coin toss.
You know, when I looked at that one, I said, you got to be kidding me. But then I actually read it and I'm like, oh, okay, that makes sense, because tossing the coin forces an emotional reaction because you're hoping for one or the other, ultimately, right? In your core of core, you're hoping for one or the other. And by flipping the coin, it forces that emotional reaction. And now all of a sudden you can say, oh, wait a minute. You know, if you're disappointed when you see that that coin fall, then maybe, you know, that's the wrong decision. So,
you know, but also to that end, two faces to a coin. Sometimes not doing something is also a decision.
No action is an action.
Is an action, yes. Right? And no, you may be tossing a coin going in between two different actions, but there's a third one there, mm-hmm. right? That's, you know, could be doing nothing for now, for a certain period True. Of time. True. So, not all decisions are cut and dry like yeah, that, yeah, right? Yeah. So,
they're not created equal.
Yeah, exactly.
But there are some items in here that makes sense, right? Fewer options makes better decisions. Well, yeah, there's not as much complexity, right? You have fewer mm-hmm. options. Decision by committee, never liked it. Right? Smaller group, yep. the better.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And they talk about when to make decisions earlier in the day mm-hmm. before yep. you're fatigued. I see that, right? I try to get sure. the work that I need to get done that's most critical, I try to do as early in the day as possible, because I know after two podcasts, by the time mm-hmm. I get out of this, my brain is fried, right? That's not the time you want to be making no. decisions.
Right.
Yeah,
I would sleep on it.
I don't Absolutely. Know, right, right, but right. I don't know about the decision fatigue, right? And let's face it, insecurity, we've got a lot of decisions to make that are very mm-hmm. Impactful. And a lot of these articles over the years on this show have talked about, you know, what to wear, what to eat, and, you know, decision fatigue. I think that if you can reduce, and I don't know if I buy into that, right? I think if you can make less decisions in your day, it gives you more time to think about other things, right? It's not necessarily like, oh, I'm making too many decisions, all these yeah. micro level decisions. I think that if you can wake up in the morning and go, yeah, I got this thing going on, like I really gotta, you know, focus on this problem, think about the pros and cons and impacts of my decision. You don't, if you don't have to think about what to wear because it's already laid out from the night before, mm-hmm. that puts you in a better place.
Agreed.
That's just my, I don't know, that's sure. just my kind of tip that's on that.
I want to skip to the last article so we have time for the next interview segment today. And Jason, you brought this one up this morning if we were covering articles about OFAC and this whole ransomware penalty, I guess is a good
On October 1st. And I knew it would spawn some debate conversation among the listeners because there's different philosophies. But there was an advisory that came out on October 1st from the Department of the Treasury. And it's titled Advisory on Potential Sanctions Risk for Facilitating Ransomware Payments. And when you start reading into it, it's basically outlining a method for the Department of Treasury to put sanctions on folks who decide, if they get hit with ransomware, to pay the ransom. And I know there's lots of philosophies out there, right? You know, don't negotiate with terrorists. Paying the ransom could actually spawn more ransomware to happen because now it becomes a business. It could force them to attack you again because they know you're willing to pay. So I figured this would spawn a good debate, you know, and good conversation around that because now the government's actually stepping in saying, we could sanction you if you pay it. And now ransomware negotiator as a job could be gone.
It could be. It's an interesting way to think about this. Yeah. Is by saying you potentially could get sanctioned, the argument here is that it would prevent fewer payouts and therefore mm-hmm. drop the overall ransom being asked for because it's less yep. likely that it's going to get paid because they're regulating the payment. I'm not sure if that's true or not.
There's the other side of the coin.
Rationale.
There's the other side of the coin now because organizations may stop announcing that they get hit with ransomware, start notifying they got hit with ransomware, and now kind of sneak it under the cover. Because I look at it both sides of the aisle, right? In theory, not negotiating with terrorists is great, but knocking on wood, right? If I ever got hit, if my company got hit, would I be feeling the same way? I don't know.
Yeah, but if less people are paying the ransom, mm-hmm. that would drive the cost up. It would be my guess that the ransomware authors would be like, I'm just going to charge people more because less people are paying. I think the real reason, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure if it's in the article mentioned somewhere, but I think the real reason not for people is not to pay the ransom mm-hmm. is you're funding cyber criminals and potentially other nation states.
That's the mindset, right?
That's yeah. We've talked about that on the shows.
That's
why I don't like to see people paying the ransom, but there's a lot more to that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. When executives get together, you have these kind of conversations. And, you know, we've seen customers get hit really, really hard with ransomware attacks. And the CFO and I are talking about it and saying, you know, and I bring up the topic of don't negotiate with terrorists. You're just enabling them to want to do it more. And he's like, But if my business was completely down and that was my only option to bring revenue back in here, damn straight I'm going to be having the conversation with you about paying a ransom. Because that's the business thinking about it, right?
That's exactly right. But now there's an impact to that business decision if the Treasury is going to come in and put sanctions in place. It changes that business decision. So what do you do as a business if you can't pay the ransom, they don't give you your data back, and you go out of business? You're going to go sue the Treasury Department?
Right.
Yeah, because I was thinking, what if you get like one free pass? Like you can pay one ransom and that's it. Like second one, now it's negligence, right? Gross negligence maybe. But that, as Matt points out, your first ransom payment, that may put you out of business regardless if you decide to pay it or not, the impact of that.
I'll tell you what it did do. This article came out and the first thing I did was get my management team together and say, we better be solid on our BCDR plan. We better start looking, you know what I mean? We better make sure that if something were to ever happen, we have our micro segmentation down to a point where nobody could get to our backup files, right? I mean, it's literally making you revisit your BCDR to ensure that it's safe. And we're talking about offline backups.
Yeah,
and,
but like that being said though, you're still, if an attacker's motivated enough, they're still going to be able to ransomware any organization on the planet if they're motivated, if they have enough resources and the like I like to say, the juice is worth the squeeze. Doesn't matter, like they're gonna go to great lengths to do that and to penalize a company.
I know.
How do you differentiate the people that have done their due diligence versus ones that have it and enforce this on a different level and say, well, almost like cyber insurance, right?
Right.
Like, and that's really kind of what this needs to look like, as much as I hate cyber insurance. But there are companies that are like Jason said, we're going through great lengths. We're micro segment.
Yep.
We're protecting our backups as best we can. That doesn't mean, I mean, you know, we all know people that could be like, well, I could still ransomware, you know, that organization. Those people are out there, right?
Yep.
So I think it's an interesting.
How do you make the juice not worth the squeeze? I guess is how you do it, right? Well, how do you make it so it's too difficult and too time consuming to want to spend that time? But honestly, this is why I brought up the article, because I think we could probably have a whole show on this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because you brought up cyber insurance, and there's conversations that I have with folks from insurance companies that I'm like, you actually have your incident response folks that you bring in recommending to go pay a ransom. What are you doing? You're literally creating a life cycle where you're creating a scenario saying ransomware is happening, buy more insurance. And by the way, pay the you know, pay the terrorists. So I think it's tons of room for debate. I think I could put myself on both sides of the aisle and really play devil's advocate on both sides, knowing the business and knowing the security side. And I just think it would be great conversation with as we learn more about what these sanctions could become. I think it'd make a great show.
See, I think what the Treasury Department needs to do now is clarify. Because if you leave this up to interpretation, this becomes very, very dangerous, right? And now every scenario could be different. So they've got to come up, I think, with some really good guidelines so people understand when they're in trouble, when they're not in trouble, and let them make decisions. But if you leave it open-ended, I think that interpretation becomes dangerous.
Are they ransomwareing and encrypting all my files? And or have they stolen my data first before they encrypted it? And they're like, what's my payment going to? Maybe they didn't even encrypt my file. Maybe they just got a copy of it. And really, that's just extortion, not necessarily ransomware, right? So like, is there a difference between that? I don't know.
That's why I left it for the last article. Gentlemen, thank you. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to welcome Parham to discuss peer-to-peer collaboration.
DeepWatch provides innovative managed security services that empower organizations to be more resilient against today's evolving cyber threats. DeepWatch offers game-changing capabilities in managed detection and response, managed endpoint detection and response, and vulnerability management, all delivered through a unique squad model, a dedicated group of security experts that works directly with each client. From managed security operations to threat hunting to continuous measurement of security readiness, DeepWatch is advancing the service of managed security. Measure your SecOps maturity for free by visiting securityweekly.com/DeepWatch. Most breaches are caused by exploiting oversights in basic cybersecurity fundamentals. But complex, hybrid, multi-cloud infrastructures make cybersecurity hygiene challenging. Red Seal can help. It shows you what's on your network, how it's connected, and the associated risk across public cloud, private cloud, and physical environments. With Red Seal, you'll get control of your cybersecurity fundamentals so you can protect your organization from the inevitable attack vectors and reduce your cyber risk. For more information, visit securityweekly.com/Red Seal.
Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by Paul Asadorian and Jason Albuquerque. Would you like to have all of your favorite Security Weekly content at your fingertips? Have a question for one of our illustrious hosts, someone from the Security Weekly team, or wish you could hang out with the Security Weekly crew and community? Subscribe on our favorite podcast, on your favorite podcast catcher, sign up for our mailing list and join our Discord server to stay in the loop on all things Security Weekly. Visit securityweekly.com/subscribe. In our October 22nd technical training, we will provide a first look at a new free resource that delivers thousands of remedies as a service to bridge the gap between vulnerabilities found and vulnerabilities fixed. On October 28th, learn how to build an integrated security platform in our webcast at 3 p.m. Eastern. Visit securityweekly.com/webcast to see what we have coming up, or visit securityweekly.com/on-demand for all of our previously recorded webcasts. Param Eftekhari is Senior Vice President and Executive Director of the Cybersecurity Collaborative, a membership community that offers cybersecurity executives peer-to-peer collaboration and exclusive CISL-created content. He also serves as founder and board chair at the Institute for Critical Infrastructure Technology, a cybersecurity think tank which helps bridge the gap between policymakers and cybersecurity leaders. With over 15 years in the technology industry, Param is a passionate advocate for national security with an ever-growing catalog of publications, media, and speaking engagements. Param, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Thank you. It is great to be here. Looking forward to a good conversation today.
I wasn't sure if we were like on a Zoom call meeting or if we were doing a show. I got confused for a minute there.
I know we were excited when we, it was hard to keep tight-lipped, but we're glad that the word is out, and just want to first start by saying welcome to the CRA family. We're really thrilled to have you guys be part of the organization.
Yeah, it's awesome to be here.
It is. In one of the interesting areas that I thought was exciting for this show specifically is the aspects of the cybersecurity collaborative and other aspects of the forums where, you know, you've got this environment already where executives and CISOs are meeting in these peer-to-peer groups. And I thought it would be a great way to bring some of that content to this show. So I'm hoping we do more, Param. But let's just start with, what is the cybersecurity collaborative? Give us a little overview and background.
Yeah, it's a great question. So our mission is very simple. We're here to help make cybersecurity leaders more successful. You know, there's so many organizations out there that are tasked with, you know, increasing collaboration, sharing knowledge, bringing different stakeholders in the community, whether it's CISOs or privacy executives and folks up and down the spectrum together to solve problems. We feel that, you know, we have a different approach to supporting this community. First of all, the knowledge sharing that we facilitate is all done by and for our members, and there are no vendors and no analysts in our membership. We love the vendor community. There are ways that we are going to be adding into our ecosystem to allow the technology partners that our members rely on to engage with our membership. But at the core of what we do, we create opportunities for cybersecurity leaders, and notice I don't say CISOs, because as you guys know, not every organization has a CISO. And so whatever you are in your cybersecurity organization, if you're leading that team, we create opportunities for you to come together, basically say, hey, you know what, right now, today, I'm facing this challenge in my organization. And when you reach out to our member services team, we will try to solve that problem for you. We look at our members portal of CISO created content, because a lot of times the problem's been asked by somebody else, and we have actually created content that's been curated from your peers, and so we can share that with you. If it's not there, we'll spin up what's called a CISO rapid response, which is basically us getting some of your colleagues on a call or just via an email thread to answer that question for you. And if that doesn't work and enough members are talking about that same challenge, we do what's called a task force, which is basically a working group of your peers trying to come together and solve that problem. So it's really all about members coming together to solve the challenges that you're facing today.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting model where, you know, we see CISOs coming from various parts of the organization, or security leaders in more general. Some come from very technical sides, some come from the business side. And so you may run into something you've never experienced before. Here's a great way to, you know, talk to a number of folks that have maybe already been there and done that to really gain knowledge and help you make some decisions about how to address some of these emerging problems. I think it's a great concept.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that we like to say is we're trying to democratize access to this information. A lot of times, and I think frankly it has to do with the economics, organizations who have this peer-to-peer sharing model, they tend to go after the Fortune 500 or Fortune 200, and that's okay, right? Those folks have a very unique set of challenges. And a lot of times they can only solve them by engaging with one another. We're fortunate to work with those as well. We have an executive committee that has CISOs from MasterCard and Yum's Brand and Aflac and Eli Lilly and Rockwell Automation and some other really reputable organizations with some of the most sought after and respected cybersecurity executives in our community. But what we all know as well is that those organizations rely tremendously on their supply chains and all the vendors that they work with, both the technology vendors and also just folks within their ecosystem. And so what we're trying to do is create opportunities where both those enterprise level organizations can collaborate and engage and learn from one another. We're also taking that knowledge, extracting it, and creating other forums, whether it's through content in the members portal or other types of collaborative experiences where the mid and even smaller size organizations can actually glean from the knowledge that those more mature cybersecurity programs have and would actually help to create more knowledge sharing up and down, you know, the cybersecurity maturity kind of program lifecycle. And that's one of the things that we're really striving towards. And the folks who join us really love that about our program and are really bought into both improving their own cybersecurity posture, but also giving back to the community, which is one of our core pillars of value.
Yeah, one of the things I noticed, you know, on your website is you coin it as a safe, trusted, proving watering hole for executives, right? Cybersecurity executives. And I think that's an important factor, right? Because I'm a big advocate of peer-to-peer networks and thought leadership and sharing information. But to know that you have a kind of the safe haven where you can bounce ideas, bounce problems. Because
and I hope more than just water. Just
more saying. Than, yes, that's what I mean. Me too. But having a place that you can actually go outside of your organization, because sometimes you want to bring your A game to your business. You want to bring your A game to the C-suite, right? So to be able to go out there and have this trusted advisory group that you can talk to and bounce ideas off of, that is kind of, you know, has the mentality of what's in these four walls stays in these four walls, I think is an important place to have, right? You need that out. You need that place to go to that you know is trusted and safe, right? From judgment, safe from, you know, any type of folks looking at you and basically saying, what do you mean you don't know that, right? And sometimes that can happen in an executive suite, right? When you're in your organization, you're sitting at the table with other executives and you don't have your A game, sometimes you can get called out on it, right? So being able to have that safe zone, I think is super, super important.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that we offer our members that we have what's called a morning security report, where every day for the past 24 hours, we have a team that curates the top news stories of the day, and our members receive it at 5:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. And I've heard countless examples of our members who are executives say, gosh, it's one of the most valuable things you offer, because no one walks down the hall anymore, but when they're walking, you know, down the hall, or they're now exchanging emails or Slack messages, when the president or CFO or a board member emails them saying, hey, did you hear about this ransomware incident in our industry? Are we prepared to handle that? They've already gotten that intelligence, right? And either they've been able to prepare for that answer, mm-hmm. they've been able to proactively respond and say, this happened in our industry and here's how we are prepared to handle that. Or to your point, they know they have a safe space to reach out to the members they've met through our organization or reach out to us and say, gosh, I just read about this in the mm-hmm. morning security report. I actually realize this may be a gap in my security program. How can you help me be more successful? And that's when our kind of machine turns on and we help them in that safe space you just very, very articulately identified.
Parham, some feedback I've gotten, and I don't want to, I obviously won't name any names, but oftentimes when I've spoken to CISOs, right, they'll bring up, I mean, not all the time, but sometimes they're like, you know, I participate in these CISO forums or some kind of CISO group, however formal or informal that is. And they're like, basically it turns into like a big bitch fest. And everyone's just sitting around complaining, and I don't really get a lot out of it. Obviously your forums are not that. So what do you do, you know, differently, and what do you make sure it doesn't steer in that direction?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I think first of all, what we do is we actually do a lot of what we call kind of continuous feedback loop, where we're making sure that we engage on the right types of topics. Secondly, it's who's guiding the conversations. A lot of times people sometimes want forums to just vent and, to your point, kind of bitch and get their frustrations out there. Right. And that's kind of, that's fine. Sometimes I guess you got to vent to somebody, but end of the day, I think what we're known for and the reason people invest their time and their money in form of membership dues to our organization is because they know that you come to us to not just say, here's what my problem is, but then actually identify solutions. Mm-hmm. What happens in our process is we'll get on that first task force call. If it's let's say a 6-week process or 8-week process meeting every other week. And we'll say, okay, guys, we're here to talk about account takeover or third party vendor risk management or whatever it may be. And we'll say, what is the specific outcome that you want out of this? Because we will say, we're not here to have a bitch fest. We want to have a right. specific outcome. So what is it? And then one of the things we ask on those calls is, so who can offer, who has a solution to this? Like, what do you guys have in your organization? And people actually, because we sign NDAs and there is that trust, and it really goes down to culture. It's easy to, you can put that on a website and say you have that, but unless you've built that culture,
right.
build that movement, and it's kind of hard to replicate. People actually share with us the policies and programs that they're using within their organization. We take it, we add to it in form of the knowledge that we're extracting on these calls. We kind of anonymize the policies that are shared with us. And then we, at the end of this process, basically spit out a cybersecurity collaborative version of a policy or best practices, recommendations, checklists, whatever that may be. And so I think to your point, I've been in the collaboration space for, gosh, I think almost a dozen years now, I'd say, maybe just a little bit under. And that was the one thing that has always kind of grinded my gears is at some point you gotta, you know, water, get off the pot. And so that's the one thing that we're really trying to drive home here. And I think we're doing a pretty good job at it.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. You recognize that early on.
Now, when you sign up for membership, do you sign up as an individual, as an organization? Because I only ask because sometimes when I'm having discussions with peers, many times I'll say, wait a minute. I know that our attorney has dealt with this before. Let me bring in my attorney to talk to you and kind of help guide you through it. With this membership, would we have the opportunity to bring our groups together and say, hey, let me bring my CFO in. My CFO has dealt with this before and give you some advice. Can you do things like that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So we are, as an organization, you sign up. Mm-hmm. And what happens is the cybersecurity leader, the CISO or CISO equivalent, becomes kind of the primary point of contact. They identify a couple what we call delegates to be the kind of number one and two and sometimes three main points of contact. And then when we have these exchanges, we leave it to them to tell us what's going to best serve their needs. To your point, is it to bring in my chief risk officer, my privacy person, my lawyer, all the above?
Yeah.
And then we obviously give unlimited, you know, number of licenses and things to access content in the members portal and get the morning security report. So it definitely is meant to be organizational in terms of the who's paying the dues.
Yeah.
And it's that cybersecurity leader that drives who's going to get involved.
That's awesome because having a level of diversity where it's not just security professionals as part of this engagement is huge. Because sometimes you need legal opinion. Sometimes you need privacy opinion. Sometimes you need a financial person to come in saying, yeah, it doesn't really work this way.
I have all those opinions, Jason. I mean, I'm not qualified for many of them.
All right, let me rephrase. Qualified opinions.
There's Paul.
No, that's exactly how we've set this up. And to that point, you know, we actually focus both on, you kind of talked about communication across these different silos. Mm. If you look at our, we're revising our website right now. We have three pillars of value. One is strategic and technical insights, kind of to do the blocking and tackling you need to do to be an effective cyber leader. The second is actually professional development for cybersecurity leaders. And so that's kind of those soft skills. Some people don't even know how to go and talk to their lawyer and talk to the heads of business and say, you guys are the reason I have a bunch. We talked about this on a call with Paul Matt the other day. You know, how do you talk to your business counterparts? Say, I have a shadow IT problem, and it's your fault. They don't even know how to open up that dialogue.
Right.
And so we're trying to teach them these soft skills and how to go outside of their IT bubble or their security bubble. And so that's part of our value prop as well, as both the cyber skills and some of those soft skills and leadership skills that you need to, I think, be really successful.
Very important. In
this but that's important to get value out of, because we do that on the show all the time. And that's the reason I joke, is that oftentimes I'm like, well, I think this is the answer, but I'm certainly not a lawyer, and don't take my legal advice, because you're probably getting a lot of trouble if you did, right? And the same thing for other very specific areas that the conversation leads it to. It's important to be able to, just like we do in the shows, bring people in who have extensive backgrounds and are qualified to speak on those various points.
Parm, what are some of the hot topics right now? Obviously, we're in this really interesting environment of remote work and the pandemic. What are some of those big topics that the executives are talking about right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the you know, again, I talked about the different communities that we work with. I would say that for some of the mid-sized organizations, they're still struggling with migrating some of their legacy applications to the cloud, and that still seems to be an issue, as well as just dealing with the bigger guys seem to have gotten a handle. I don't want to say that they've solved this whole mass migration of their workforce to the cloud, but they seem to have gotten a handle of it a little bit faster. I think the mid small size organizations are still struggling a little bit with this, and so talking about the process we went through, we addressed and got a lot of knowledge from those bigger organizations. Now we're sharing that with the mid and small size members that we have. Asset management, I kind of hinted at this a little bit earlier, is a very big topic right now that we're focused a lot on. Vulnerability management is another big area. And I think overall, there is a no matter what topic we're focused on, there's a clear acknowledgement that this paradigm shift in how organizations, and you can see my dog walking in the corner there. this clear shift in how we have absolutely fundamentally changed the workforce landscape. Every organization realizes that the majority of their employees for the foreseeable future are going to be working outside of the office. And a lot of organizations weren't set up that way. Their security policies, the way that they train their employees, their network configurations, nothing was set up to accommodate and account for this type of a work environment. And it's really taking a step back and saying, I need to do a complete reassessment of how this new way of life is going to be impacting risk to my organization. And so we're kind of taking all the pieces of a security program step by step and reevaluating based on how we feel the future is going to be. So this work from home, I think it happened so fast. If you look at all the topics and we did it too, so I'm not saying we were somehow, you know, clairvoyant, but if you look at all the topics at events and things like that, it was all, you know, it was all focused on kind of the work from home. I think we're seeing an evolution of that. And now we're going to, I think in the future, talk about continuity of operations and a different form of resiliency, given this new paradigm shift that we've seen.
How has it changed collaboration? Because you probably can't do much physical collaboration. Is everything virtual now? Have you figured out how to effectively collaborate with all of your members in this kind of remote kind of virtual world?
Yeah, that's we have because our membership, and this is a unique aspect that a lot of folks actually enjoy from our organization. A lot of the groups that are out there are very regional. And so pre-pandemic, folks would physically get together and do this collaboration in person. Because we were always a national organization, we actually historically had done a lot of our collaboration virtually. And so really wasn't that big of a shift for us to accommodate to the telework, you know, Zoom type conferencing. We always had a process to get everyone on calls. We would, you know, have the quilted effect, so to speak, where everyone dials in. You know, contributes and collaborates that way. We have a process to capture the notes, capture the information, constantly share back the content kind of in an evolving manner so people see how these documents are progressing. So I'll be honest, I think given the national makeup of our community, we were actually well positioned to withstand that aspect of the pandemic's impact.
Do the executives miss the physical collaboration? I'm just curious what their thoughts are, because, you know, a lot of us used to go to events and meet with our peers. Do they miss that aspect of the physical collaboration, or is the virtual enough for them right now?
You know, I think what I'm sensing, you know, being a very social guy who loves to, you know, network afterwards and have cocktails, and I think that's where you really have a different, a very much needed and important layer of building trust. We all know that this industry is more than others is about trust. So I think you have to have that in-person collaboration to build that a certain layer of trust. I think on one hand, absolutely we miss it. It's important. And especially if you want to really get into some detail type of sharing. I think on the other hand, what I've heard particularly from very senior executives is the lack of travel has freed up a significant amount of time where they're actually able to contribute more to these types of efforts because they're able to speak on more panels and participate in more of these roundtables because they're just doing it from their office like we all are and doing it from home. And so they've actually been able to find more time to participate and contribute than before. So I think there's a pros and cons to this new environment. And I think, you know, I predict when we are able to go back to full-fledged conferences, you know, we're excited that you guys announced your conference in fall of next year. Obviously, CRA, you know, has InfoSec World and all the great CRA learning events that we do. The Cybersecurity Collaborative, right? We will be having our own in-person events for our members as well, just maybe one or two a year. So I think it's an important component of it, but I think we'll find probably much more balance as we go forward. I think indefinitely, I think this has absolutely changed how we collaborate as a global society.
So from a membership perspective, I mean, one of the first things I look at when becoming a member is what am I entitled to, right? So what content are you delivering? What types of entitlements do we get as a member?
Yeah, so we have three different membership tiers for basically small, medium, large companies, right, to keep it simple. On the small, for small businesses, or frankly, for the folks who don't have, big budget, and our small business, the list price is $7,500 a year, and we have scholarships to subsidize some of that cost for organizations that may not have money, right? At the end of the day, one of the reasons we do this is because we believe deeply in the role that the private sector plays in national security. And that's a whole different conversation. I was talking to the former general counsel of the NSA this morning about the complete shift and how we need to defend our national security and the role that the private sector plays on this. And we're trying to do our part by not just creating these opportunities to commoditize the information, but also making it available from an economic perspective. So we have a small business level, which gives you all the access to the content in the members portal, which is, we have, anyone's interested and give you countless examples of CISOs have said this document has saved $25,000, has saved $50,000 of consulting fees. I mean, these are actual tools and policies. We have a CISO handbook that consists of, about 400 pages of different policies, implementable policies for you to build or fill gaps within your CISO program. And so, that level is more the content in the members portal and your security report and access to different briefings that we do that are more for our members. For mid and large size organizations, that's when the actual collaboration comes into play. So these are when you have the ability to call a CISO rapid response and you say, you know, an example recently was somebody was presenting to a board. And it was a presentation that came up on last minute. They wanted to validate whether the slides that they were using and the way they were presenting a bunch of really data-rich information was the way that their peers were presenting it. Mm-hmm. So we spun up a CISO rapid response. We had around, I think, four members get on a call, share with this particular member their slides. They revamped their whole presentation, and we did all this within a couple of days. Oh, we have a ton of those examples. Yeah, it's really, really powerful. And then, of course, the task force is being involved in that collaborative process. So really, it's the task forces, the rapid responses, the morning security reports, the content in the members portal, and the different types of briefings and things that we do for our members. And we have a different price scales for small, medium, and large type members.
Awesome.
Awesome. So Parm, if people want to sign up or learn more, where should they go?
Yeah, a few places. You can go to our website is cyberleadersunite.com. We are very active on LinkedIn as well. A lot of great content there. So look us up on LinkedIn at the Cybersecurity Collaborative, which is on LinkedIn. Cyber Leaders Unite on Twitter as well. Best place is probably our website, cyberleadersunite.com. And we'd love for you guys to check us out and have a conversation about being involved.
That's awesome. Parham, thank you so much for joining us on Business Security Weekly.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. Look forward to chatting more with you guys about all the great things we're doing together.
We look forward to it as well. Thank you, everyone, for watching and listening. We'll see you next week on Business Security Weekly.